Hello, everyone. Welcome to the D.C. Circuit's rulings on EPA greenhouse gas rulemaking. My name is Chandra Middleton. I'm the director of the Associates Program at the Environmental Law Institute. Before we begin, I just wanted to give a big thanks to our co-sponsors, who are AIDA, the ABA Section on Environment, Energy, and Resources, also the Air Quality Section, the D.C. Bar's Energy, Environment, and Natural Resources Section, and the Georgetown Climate Center. With that, ELI's President John Cruden.
Thank you, and thank you for all of you that are listening to us. We have now an extraordinary number of phone lines that have gone out, and we're doing it in this format because we wanted to do it right away. We told everyone that we would, in fact, run a program within 24 hours of the time that the decision came out, and we're doing exactly that. Many of you were with us right after oral argument, and you remember that after those two historic days in the ceremonial courtroom of the District of Columbia, we also did a full-day discussion where over 350 people and over 10 press organizations came to listen to many of us talk then about what I believe is one of the most important set of arguments and one of the most important decisions that have come out of any court since the Supreme Court decided Massachusetts versus EPA. And so I'm very pleased that we also have the experts with us. These are Clean Air Act gurus. Several of them participated or argued in the case itself. We are going to tell you our presentations what we think this historic decision means. Here's what we're going to do. We have over an hour with you. Our plan is, in fact, to give you our views of the 82 pages of the decision. We're breaking it up into four parts, and I'll describe those four parts to you. Once we have gone over, the experts have spoken, then I will have some questions for them, and we may well, in fact, have some discussion among ourselves, because remember, this is the first time that we've had an opportunity talk to one another about what we think this decision means. Once we're done with that, then you as an audience can submit questions. You can, in fact, can submit questions anytime you want, and we will actually do those questions toward the end of our presentation. And here's how you do it. It's simple. Just write this down. It's Middleton, M-I-D-D-L-E-T-O-N, at ELI.org. So that's Middleton at ELI.org. You can send a question, and it'll get relayed to us to answer. So I'm going to start by introducing our panel, and I think after I get done, you'll understand just how pleased we are to have this group of three joining us. I am John Cruden. I'm the president of Environmental Law Institute. Before I came here, I was at Department of Justice for a number of years. I was responsible for environmental litigation, including all the greenhouse gas cases. I did not participate in the briefing of these cases, so anything I say is clearly my own views. Up first will be David Doniger. He will actually do parts two and three. He will be discussing the endangerment finding and the tailpipe rule. David, as many of you know, is the policy director for climate and clean air at NRDC. But David spent many years at EPA, where he was the director of climate change policy. And before that, he was counsel to the head of EPA's Clean Air Act program. David at NRDC focuses on the policies to cut global warming pollution from power plants, motor vehicles, and other major industries, and he, in fact, submitted an amicus brief in this case. He will be followed by Bill Brownell. Bill is a partner in Hunton and Williams and very well known for his Clean Air Act expertise. Bill is going to be covering parts 4 and 5 of the opinion. Parts 4 cover basically what I think of as the ripeness of the challenge by industry and states to EPA's thoughts about PSD interpretation, and then Part 5, the merits of that PSD interpretation. But Bill has a broad practice of environmental litigation, regulation, and counseling, which clearly includes not only a variety of Clean Air Act issues and a variety of environmental issues, but also very specifically to climate change. And he argued before the D.C. Circuit in this case. He was also counsel for a related case, counsel which is Connecticut versus EPA, and he has been lead counsel and is lead counsel in many of the leading cases in the D.C. Circuit involving NSR and revised air quality standards. And then finally, who will speak on standing, which is part 6 of the opinion, is Tim Profepa. Tim is the founding director of the Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions, and he's a professor of practice at Duke University's Stanford School of Public Policy. Before coming to Duke, Tim was served as counsel on the environment to Senator Joe Lieberman, and he was one of the principal architects of the Lieberman-McCain climate bill in 2003. He's also represented Senator Lieberman in legislative negotiations, covering a wide range of environment and energy issues, and we're delighted to have Tim as part of this panel. So what I'm going to do to open is the introduction. I'm going to basically set the stage for the other speakers, and I will be covering what is summarized in part 1 of this opinion. Part 1 starts as the court starts with the Supreme Court's historic decision in Massachusetts versus EPA. That is very logical, since two of the people on the panel were on Massachusetts versus EPA. Sentell, the Chief Justice of the D.C. Circuit, writing for a majority, and Tatel in dissent. Rogers, the third judge on the D.C. Circuit, also participated because the Department of Justice sought en banc, and she was one of the justices reviewing the en banc petition. They did not grant en banc, and that was the way it went to the Supreme Court. So it, again, is quite logical for the court to describe the beginning, the genesis of all of this as Massachusetts versus EPA. And at oral argument, Sentell in particular reminded virtually everybody that he was bound by Massachusetts versus EPA. I don't recall whether actually he told everybody that he had been, you know, reversed or not, but we all knew that. But that comes out, I believe, during a lot of the opinion is, in fact, its adherence to the language of Massachusetts versus EPA. I, however, do not start the greenhouse gas saga quite with Massachusetts versus EPA. I would actually start it in California, which is somewhat relevant. California, which has the ability under the Clean Air Act to give its own California car standards, asked EPA during the last administration to do precisely that and set greenhouse gas standards, the first in the nation. The administration, after a long thought process and an EPA general counsel opinion, declined to do so, and California sued. And that resulted in a whole series of procedural skirmishes, but never a final decision. But I do believe that that start had an enormous impact on this administration, an enormous impact on the flow of how the rulemaking proceeded. Obviously, Massachusetts versus EPA also started with a petition for rulemaking, and as we all know, in that case, EPA again declined to regulate, and which led then to ultimately the Supreme Court's decision. Massachusetts versus EPA narrowly said that CO2 is a pollutant, but still required EPA to do something. It had to go back to EPA, and they had to decide, pursuant to the statute, whether or not this was a pollutant that caused problems, that it caused harm. That is what we all now call the endangerment finding, and that's what David is going to talk about and the court's resolution of the challenge to that very first start. But once EPA made their endangerment finding, once they Administrator Jackson signed that document, that it was a final decision, then the dominoes of rulemaking started. The very first domino was, in fact, with cars and light trucks. And that was the first application of their decision that carbon dioxide is, in fact, a pollutant that needs to be regulated. That was the very first time, and it resulted in two historic acts. The first historic act was EPA joining with NHTSA, so they come up with a joint rulemaking, first time that it had ever happened. And then second, in negotiations and discussions with the auto industry agreed. So much so that the auto industry did not challenge the car and light truck rule. And David is going to discuss that rule and the resolution by the Court of Appeals. But with those two parts, with in fact the first part, which is the endangerment finding, and then its precise application as a pollutant in the context of a rulemaking status, here cars and light trucks, then the next set of rulemaking domino continued. EPA had long taken the position that if in fact if a regulable pollutant also demanded that there in fact be stationary source compliance, in this case PSD, prevention of serious of significant deterioration under the Clean Air Act. And they did so. So they, in fact, started with those stationary sources, and they started in ways that I'll mention in a minute with the biggest stationary sources. But they did that because, in fact, they felt bound by their own interpretation of PSD and the statutory language that governed PSD. And so the first domino is endangerment finding. The second domino is its application to cars and light trucks. The third domino is stationary sources, in this case, the PSD rule. And that's what Bill is going to talk about. Bill is going to talk about the industry and state challenge to the interpretation that EPA had given many years ago PSD and how it affects and whether or not the National Ambient Air Quality Standards applied or do not apply. And he will deal with the fourth part of the opinion, which was the challenge to that by the Department of Justice that said this is not ripe for review. And once Bill has discussed part four, then in fact he will deal with the merits. By the way, since I'm telling you all that part five deals with the merits, if you have not read the opinion, I, of course, have already let the cat out of the bag. Because, as you will see on standing, the court does not discuss something that they don't find jurisdiction. So, obviously, they found it was ripe for review, or we would not have Bill talking about the merits. So you can kind of figure out, if you haven't read the opinion, part five, or at least the conclusion to part four. Part five I will leave open for them. Well, all right, so now once you have discussed the whole decision-making, these dominoes that I have talked about, only then do you get to what was clearly the most controversial of all of the rulemaking, and that is the so-called tailoring rule. And that is the application EPA's interpretation of what they thought they needed to do in PSD to stationary sources. But here's the rub. They decided that the statutory language was going to bring in way too many sources, and so by rulemaking, they chose a threshold that was lower than the statutory amount, and they gave a number of reasons why they needed to do that. And they have doctrines of absurd results and doctrines of administrative necessity and so forth. But fundamentally, what complicated it is that EPA was proposing a standard that was higher than the statutory amount in order to have a lower number of sources covered. And so that was, in fact, the absolute controversy with it. And that part, or at least the resolution of that issue, is what Tim is going to talk about, because he deals with Part 6, and that's the standing question. So obviously, the whole aspect of the so-called tailoring rule is all very caught up in a threshold jurisdictional Article 3 type of debate as to whether or not the individuals, companies, states challenging that important rule, the tailoring rule, had standing. So now, only now, will I turn basically to just a little bit about the court argument before I turn it over to David. The court argument was, in fact, 2 days of argument, which is historic by itself. Those of us who practice regularly before the D.C. Circuit, you know, it's a big deal in our lives to get 30 minutes, you know, for a side to argue. And here is a dedication of 2 days for it. On top of that, it was every one of these rules. I'm talking about this, but there's actually separate cases, three or four different cases that would all be argued over a two-day period. And the Court of Appeals was actually very specific as to how much time. It came down into individual minutes that people got to argue, and it was a disciplined 2 days, starting in exactly the same sequence that we are presenting to you, which is to say, starting with endangerment finding, leading to cars and light trucks, going there then to PSD interpretation, and finally ending up with the tailoring rule. It was a rainy day, as I recall. The lines went out way farther than you would expect because this was the, and we all understood, this is one of the most important cases in environmental law, certainly of this year, and I would argue again since Massachusetts versus EPA came out. They used overfill courtrooms to handle that. And then we all rose, of course, when Sentell and Rogers and Tatel came in, and it started quickly after that. The attorneys were quite well prepared. This is one of these rare opinions where the first 15 pages are all just the attorneys who worked on that. And if you looked over the list, you'll see the leading Clean Air Act attorneys in the nation working on that. But the court was impressive. The court was actually quite impressive. They obviously knew, they'd obviously read everything, they were quite capable. You could tell that they realized the importance of this. It was a courtroom that also had law students. Several different law schools were there, and at one stage, I recall Tatel leaning over, looking at the law students to his left, and basically saying, "I hope you understand, it doesn't get any better than this." And by that, I think he meant the richness of the legal issues, the quality of the arguments, but the significance of the case. Some of you have commented because I have written about this, and I've said I came away with a great passion and a great feeling for our legal structure. I am an environmentalist. I wanted EPA to prevail, but I've said in writing, no matter how this case came out, this is good justice. The voices were heard, the judges were informed, the lawyers were good. These are the kind of things that we should honor in our area. So with that very quick introduction, that very quick summary of part one, David, what did the court do on endangerment finding? What did they do with the linchpin of all this? What happened?
Thanks, John, and thanks all of you for joining us today. NRDC's long push for action on the carbon pollution that's driving climate change, and so this was, and we were an intervener in this case, along with other environmental groups in the states. So yesterday's decision is especially sweet for us. Starting with endangerment, let me make actually a comment about the whole package. It's been my view that these cases, I guess it was a bit of a risk to say so in my blog, were not really very threatening as lawsuits themselves, but they're part of a broader political attack on climate science and on EPA and the Clean Air Act, which actually continues today in the House, where the Appropriations Committee subcommittee is re-adopting amendments to block EPA from regulating greenhouse gases, and actually an amendment that would bar EPA from implementing the next phase of the Clean Car Standards. How out of touch. As lawsuits, though, these were brought mainly to dress up this political argument. If you are asking Congress to change the law, you have to show you've gone to court to do what you can under the existing law. Anyway, that was my view, and fortunately I've been proved right, at least in yesterday's opinion. So focusing on endangerment, here you have an administrative decision on a very complex scientific matter, but it's very much in the tradition of EPA and other agencies dealing with complex scientific issues in environmental areas, occupational health areas, and so on. So you have threats to public health, to the environment. You have very, very good information, but not perfect certainty. You never have perfect certainty. And in this case, you have a mountain, actually the court called it an ocean, of scientific evidence. Actually much better than most, or much more extensive and more powerful than even the kinds of information that lies behind such momentous historical decisions as the ban on leaded gasoline, or even the decision that smoking causes cancer. This climate change science is in that league, or maybe better. So there were a number of challenges brought by the petitioners. They could be classed in a couple of different groups. I'll go through them. The first really could be considered an attack on Massachusetts versus EPA, because the challengers were saying that the EPA had to engage in a lot of complex policy making and economic decision making before it could make a science-based decision that the pollution endangers public health or welfare. The court yesterday pointed out that that's the same kind of attack that the Supreme Court rejected in Massachusetts, saying, no, the question of endangerment is a scientific one. The question of economics or other policy issues is for later in the statute, if later provisions in the statute so provide. But they're not relevant to the threshold determination: is the pollution dangerous, and does the, in this case, the motor vehicles, do they contribute to that pollution with their emissions? So the court reaffirmed referred to the Massachusetts holding that what's required is a scientific judgment. The court specifically rejected an argument that before deeming these pollutants to be dangerous, EPA had to consider and weigh the supposed economic consequences of triggering all these dominoes that John mentioned, especially in the mind of the petitioners, the triggering the requirement that new sources, large new sources, get permits showing that they're using the best available control technology. I may be intruding just a smidge on William's Bill's turf if I say that we pointed out that, look, the PSD provisions themselves provide that in the definition of best available control technology, that costs are to be considered. So Congress had in mind when and how costs should be considered in the permitting process. The court agreed that the decision on endangerment had nothing to do with those later issues. The second thing that the challengers argued was that EPA had outsourced its decision-making to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the National Academy of Sciences, and the U.S. Global Climate Change Research Program, because what EPA had done was rely on syntheses of the tens of thousands of scientific papers that were, these syntheses were compiled by those organizations for the purpose of making some sense out of all of them and drawing the main conclusions out of the scientific literature. And as I've said elsewhere, this was this process is like a mountain of peer review. You have tens of thousands of peer-reviewed publications individually in the scientific literature. You have a synthesis process in which panels of scientists synthesize and then peer-review their syntheses. You have a further level of review by governments before the IPCC conclusions are done. And then EPA put its own review of these documents out to a further review by government scientists across the U.S. government. So the one thing we're not sure of in this process is peer review. I just read one passage from page 27 of the court. It dismissed the claim of delegation or outsourcing as, quote, little more than a semantic trick. And it said it makes no difference that much of the scientific evidence in large part consisted of syntheses of individual studies and research. Even individual studies and research papers often synthesize past work in an area and then build on it. This is how science works. EPA is not required to reprove the existence of the atom every time it approaches a scientific question. There were a number of other challenges, but I would emphasize at this point that, you know, the formal role of the court is basically to decide whether the agency had done something so off the wall that it could be called arbitrary. And often courts don't say much about the merits of the evidence themselves. And this court respected that role, but they did allow themselves to summarize the very strong evidence that EPA compiled. And I would refer you to pages 28, 29, and 30 for that summary. The court specifically rejected complaints that these findings are not completely certain. Requiring EPA to find certain endangerment before regulating would effectively prevent EPA from doing the job Congress gave it, utilizing emission standards to prevent reasonably anticipated endangerment from maturing into concrete harm. That goes all the way back through Ethel Corporation and a long line of D.C. Circuit decisions on precautionary action. I will mentioned that the state challengers had some very conspiratorial claims based on excerpts from the ClimateGate hacked emails and a handful of isolated and admitted and corrected scientific errors among the tens of thousands of scientific papers underlying the IPCC. They were so substantial as this. There was one paper that misstated the square mileage of the Netherlands. And there was another paper that got wrong the rate at which the Himalayan glaciers were melting. There were some sunspot-related challenges. They didn't even rise to the level of getting a response from the court. So that pretty much does it for the endangerment determination. It was upheld in all its respects. There was one complaint that the EPA had put all six of the main greenhouse gases into a basket and deemed that to be the pollution and that to be the pollutant. There was a complaint that EPA couldn't do this because two of the pollutants, perfluorocarbons, PFCs, and sulfur hexafluoride, are not emitted from motor vehicles. The court sidestepped that because no one they found had standing to complain about that. There was no one in the case who had proved that they had any consequences to follow for them from the inclusion of those two pollutants. On the merits, I think the EPA would have won that point because, for example, volatile organic compounds is a hodgepodge of thousands or at least hundreds of organic chemicals. EPA regulates them as a group, but no one industry emits them all. So VOC standards cover what VOCs your particular industry emits. And in this respect, the greenhouse gas standard will cover what greenhouse gases your particular industry emits. Turning quickly to the clean car standards, the remarkable thing here to underline what John said is that these clean car standards are a product of what I've called the Clean Car Peace Treaty that resolved a 10-year dispute between the car companies, the environmentalists, the states, in particular California, and others. California had set its own standards, as John mentioned. The automakers had sued in several district courts to overturn those standards on the basis that they were preempted by the fuel economy law. The Supreme Court held that the Clean Air Act and the fuel economy law coexist quite nicely, and after that, the district courts ruled against the auto industry. I guess maybe I'm telling a story that hasn't been told in public, but I suggested to one of the car makers that a deal could be had. National standards at the California levels in exchange for some folding into this the California standards. And that person said, oh, this is great, good idea, but the California Air Resources Board will never go for that. So I phoned the head of the California Air Resources Board and suggested the same proposition, and she said, this is a great idea, but General Motors will never go for that. There ensued about a year of negotiations, which the Obama administration, to its credit, the time was right and the situation was right for the Obama administration bringing the Transportation Department, EPA, together with California and all the players to negotiate the agreement, which was reached and implemented with the standards that raise fuel economy and lower carbon pollution under the two agencies' respective authorities for 5 years from 2012 to 2016. That's what was up for review in this case. There's a second agreement which goes out to 2025, which we expect to be formally promulgated next month or the month after. And these are historic achievements, saving consumers thousands of dollars at net because of the amount of money they save on the fuel they don't have to buy, and cutting emissions dramatically so that by 2025, carbon pollution will be down by half for new cars compared to a couple years ago, and mileage will be doubled compared to what it was. The car makers supported this. The challengers opposed this largely because the regulation of vehicles, and this is where Bill will pick up in a moment, triggered the permit program for large stationary sources. And that was EPA's view. That was the court's conclusion. They held that EPA was unambiguously correct in that interpretation. I know the challengers didn't feel that way, But at this point in the motor vehicle standards, the challengers were saying, EPA, you can't issue those standards. You have to take into account costs, and you can't issue those standards without taking into account all the costs related to the triggering of the stationary sources, not just the costs related to the motor vehicle industry. The court yesterday held that that was wrong. A previous case had already decided that the cost considerations in 202 are limited to those related to the car maker's costs, and car makers weren't challenging. Nobody was challenging any of the features of the car standards themselves, and that was an easy one. So I will stop there and turn the baton over to Bill.
Thank you, David, and thanks, John, and Tim. Let me preface my remarks by just saying that my discussion will reflect my views in summary and not those of any of my clients. I'm going to talk about Section 4 of the decision on ripeness and Section 5 on the merits issues. Of course, the Section 4 ripeness responds to the Department of Justice argument that the challenges here should have been filed many years ago and that petitioners were precluded now from filing the challenges. And whether or not the court was going to accept that argument that these challenges were precluded depended on whether the court found them ripe then or ripe now. It might be good to start out by talking about what is ripeness. Ripeness is a doctrine, like standing, that's founded in the Constitution that governs whether an issue is presented in a sufficiently concrete manner to be suitable for judicial review. So as the court observes, an issue may be justiciable in a purely legal sense, but it's not ripe for review unless a party faces a threatened or immediate injury. And, of course, if an issue is not ripe for review, a court has no jurisdiction to hear it. The court begins its ripeness discussion with a summary of the PSD program, noting that since 1978, EPA has defined the key term under PSD, major stationary source, as a source that emits any air pollutant regulated under the Clean Air Act. The court continues that industry, in fact, challenged that 1978 rule way back in Alabama Power. Of course, under 307B of the Clean Air Act, as any of us Clean Air Act practitioners know, challenges to a rule must be brought within 60 days of a rule's publication in the Federal Register, or else the challenge is waived. And this is what Department of Justice was using to argue that challenges presented now were precluded because this issue had been addressed in rules long ago and could have been challenged in those rules long ago. The court observes that an exception to the general rule regarding preclusion of judicial review is the ripeness doctrine. And in this regard, the court observes that it would have lacked jurisdiction to hear claims regarding greenhouse gas regulation in 1978 or 1980 when the rule was updated, or in 2002 for at least certain of the industry petitioners, as they became subject to the PSD program only as a result of action that EPA took in the tailpipe rule. So as the court says at page 48 of its decision, prior to promulgation of the tailpipe rule, no member's facility for certain of the petitioners had triggered PSD review by virtue of emissions of non-criteria pollutants. Now that greenhouse gases are regulated as a non-criteria pollutant, many will have to obtain PSD permits. So they now face concrete, immediate or threatened harm as a result of the tailoring rule, making it ripe now. For this reason, the court concludes that industry petitioners' challenges to the timing and tailoring rule are now both timely and ripe. And on that basis, it proceeds to the merits challenge. Turning to the merits of petitioners' challenges to the timing and tailoring rules, the court begins once again with a summary of key aspects of the PSD program. The court notes that prevention of significant deterioration largely focuses on maintenance of the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. And it notes further that PSD applies in areas that are attainment for ambient standard pollutants. The court then describes Section 165A of the Clean Air Act as the key substantive provision in the PSD program, which the court says provides for PSD permits and best available control technology for each pollutant subject to regulation under the Act. Once the tailpipe rule became effective, the rule that David talked about, therefore the court reasons, greenhouse gases became a pollutant subject to regulation under the Act and therefore became covered by the PSD program by operation of law. In the words of the court, and this is at pages 53 to 54 of this slip opinion, once the tailpipe rule took effect and made greenhouse gases a regulated pollutant under Title II, that is the mobile source provision of the Clean Air Act, the PSD program automatically applied to facilities emitting over 100 or 250 tons per year of greenhouse gases. Based on this reasoning, the court agrees with EPA's interpretation that led to the timing and tailoring rules, that is, that regulation of greenhouse gases under PSD occurred automatically by operation of law based on the tailpipe rule. This is compelled, the court says, by the statute and by the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts. The court went on and found further support for this conclusion in the Section 169(1) definition of major emitting facility, which subjects to PSD facilities that emit any air pollutant in amounts above the 100-250 ton per year threshold. And it found support in the Supreme Court's holding in Massachusetts that the definition of air pollutant in Section 302G, the general definitional provision of the Clean Air Act, includes greenhouse gases. So having concluded that PSD regulation of greenhouse gases is compelled by the statute in Massachusetts, the court then goes on to address industry arguments, suggesting that EPA, in fact, had discretion to interpret PSD more narrowly to avoid the enormous impacts that would result by making greenhouse gases a PSD pollutant, such that any facility emitting greenhouse gases above the 100-250 ton per year statutory threshold is potentially subject to PSD. For example, the court concluded that Congress clearly intended that PSD apply not only to substances that pollute locally or that affect local air quality, but rather that Congress intended PSD to apply more broadly as well to global pollutants and global effects. This is at pages 60 to 61 of the decision. The court also rejects the argument that PSD can be triggered only by emissions of criteria pollutants, reasoning that it could find nothing in the PSD provisions to suggest a narrower meaning for air pollutant in the PSD context than the meaning given the term by the Supreme Court in Massachusetts under Section 302G. And the court observed that because Clean Air Act Section 166 only provides steps for adding new criteria pollutants to PSD, and because greenhouse gases are not subject to the Ambient Air Quality Standard Program, Section 166 has no applicability to greenhouse gases. At the end of its analysis, the court says that we agree with industry petitioners that phrases like any air pollutant are in certain contexts capable of a more limited meaning, presumably in order to preserve consistency with congressional intent. But the court says here it was unable to identify any reasons that the phrase should be read more narrowly here. So having concluded that the Clean Air Act requires PSD and Title V permits for greenhouse gases, the court says that the timing and tailoring rule could be understood only as action to relax statutory requirements. And this, of course, led to the standing analysis, which Tim will now discuss. So, Tim?
Thank you, Bill, and thank you to ELI and David and for joining in this conference call. I'd like to sort of start just by thinking about the ruling generally and its effect on the effect of the ruling going forward. I just wanted to observe a couple of broad things before we go into standing. One is that I as the only non-litigant on the call, see this ruling as a clear underpinning of EPA's authority, and it's on much firmer ground today than it was 2 days ago, partially because of the strength of the language, but really how the court went back to Mass v. EPA, how it ruled as per curiam, and the chief judge's role in the decision. Thus, I think the battleground is really now going to turn to Congress on this issue, and it'll be a question to be answered whether we end up in a narrow fight over the authority of the agency or really looking to evolve to a broader level going forward. But those were just some general comments I thought to put at the top. My focus is on the Section 6 of the opinion, which dealt with both the timing and the tailing rules. So once the EPA had proceeded through John's dominoes falling, it felt required to issue two rules on sort of the administrative implementation of the greenhouse gas program, first of which was a timing rule that simply said that established the effective date of stationary source regulation January 1st, 2011, which is a coincidence with the tailpipe rule coming into effect, and a second rule on the tailing rule, which forewent the statutory numbers as to what the triggers were for permitting under PSD and Title V, changed those numbers from 100 and 250 tons per year up to numbers at 75,000, 100,000 per year. Both those were challenged by petitioners in this case, and as it's already been foreshadowed, the court did not reach the merits of those claims because it ruled that there was no standing by the petitioners, Article 3 standing by the petitioners to bring those claims. First, just to review the rule and the justifications the agency put forward to it. The timing rule, I think it's fair to say that the court seemed a bit confused why this challenge is being brought before it, because the effect of the rule is only to delay the PSD and Title V permitting requirements until January 2nd, 2011, a date that was now in the past. The court is unclear on what practical effect vacating that rule would have had. So the focus really was on the tailing rule and the rule that expanded increased the tons thresholds for the permitting requirements. EPA established that rule because it intended to, quote, relieve the overwhelming permitting burdens that would, in the absence of the rule, fall on the authorities and the sources. Page 74 of the opinion does a good iteration of the numbers that EPA came up with about the expansion in permits per year and staff necessary to implement those permits per year that were required are in several orders of magnitude if the EPA went to the statutory 100 and 250 tons per year levels for permitting. So EPA, citing three doctrines, decided that it would expand the permitting numbers to the 75,000, 100,000 levels. First doctrine was the doctrine of absurd results. Because these numbers were so large and so burdensome, the agency argued that it would be absurd to require it to use the statutory numbers. Second was a doctrine of administrative necessity, again, rooted in the burden that would come from the rule. And the third was the one step at a time doctrine, with the quote from Mass v. EPA to support was that agencies like legislatures do not generally resolve massive problems in one fell regulatory swoop, or implicitly that the agency could take a stepwise approach to it. The court in yesterday's opinion recited these, but these justifications, but I don't believe gave any indication of whether it felt they were well taken or not. It also recited the petitioner's challenge to those arguments, again without I believe any indication of a preference for either argument. Instead, the court ruled on these issues on the basis of Article III standing. Article III standing, as everybody here would, I believe, knows already, states that a petitioner only can bring a case if he or she has suffered an injury in fact that is concrete, particularized, was caused by the conduct, and was as likely as opposed to merely speculative. In its ruling, the court found both that there was no concrete and particularized injury, and that some of the arguments from petitioners established only a speculative injury. So this is interesting grounds for this. I think you could read that this was a grounds where judges Sentell and Tatel could find comfortable meanings of mind on the tailing rule, and since it was dispositive, they never had to reach the merits. The first and primary grounds for standing that came from the petitioners was that the petitioners were being injured because they had such increased burden upon them from greenhouse gas regulation, and that they would, in terms of the states, how they would have to administer the program, and in terms of regulated entities and to have been regulated under the program, the court pretty quickly dismisses this argument, saying neither the timing nor the tailing rules cause the injury the petitioners allege, having to comply with the PSD and Title V programs. Instead, the timing and tailing rules actually mitigate their purported injuries. The agency, by promulgating the tailing rule, is actually lessening the burden. The court had a very succinct sentence when, after iterating the petitioner's argument, where it said, "Far from it. If anything, vacature of the tailing rule would significantly exacerbate the petitioner's injury." And here I would defer to my two colleagues who were party to the litigation, but it seems that in the litigation and the briefing, the petitioners decided that they needed to posit alternative theories of standing after the first round of briefs. So two alternative theories were proposed by the state petitioners in their reply brief, and both of these were also knocked aside by the court. The first theory was that lower levels, the 100, 250 tons per year levels, if applied, would force Congress to enact corrective legislation because of the impact and the burden of having to be regulated at these low levels. This led the court to use for the second time, as I can find in a quick Westlaw search in history, a citation to Schoolhouse Rock when a bill becomes a law, and note that it is inherently speculative as to whether Congress would intervene in this, and reminds us the difficulties of the legislative process that we all know well. Hence, since congressional action as a remedy is speculative, the court knocked aside that alternative theory as well. The second alternative theory that was put forward by petitioners was one to, you'd say, put themselves in the cloak of an environmental plaintiff and claim that the states, as Massachusetts had claimed in Mass v. EPA, the states would be impacted by the negative effects of greenhouse gas emissions, and thus were being harmed by the lack of regulation of the smaller sources by the tailing rule. The court seemed very dismissive of this and skeptical of this as well, saying it was completely without merit. First, it says that this issue was not replied, was not raised until the reply brief, which is contrary to the requirements. And second, the second paragraph also goes after the lack of any evidentiary basis that was proffered for this case. The court says that the state petitioners failed to cite any record evidence to suggest they are adversely affected, in stark contrast to Massachusetts. Some have, in conversations over the past 24 hours, posited whether this paragraph could be something that creates a new evidentiary bar for standing for an environmental plaintiff. I personally, in my own opinion, don't read it much of a change from practice on standing in this language. it's really more of a declaration of what the requirement is rather than the change in the requirement. And seems to be a little bit of a slap at the state petitioners because they are, the court is illustrating how this does seem to be an ex post theory of standing raised only in a reply brief because they never even put forward the necessary evidence to create it. And with that, I will conclude the discussion of standing and pass the microphone back to John.
Thank you to all of you. I have now received numerous questions from the audience. And so what I'm going to do, in addition to some asking some of my own, I'm going to be asking some of yours as well of each of the participants. But here's the rules. And that is, I'm going to direct my question at one of our experts. And then when that person is done, then anybody else can chime in of the other experts as to what they say, and we'll do as many of the questions as we can. But I want to start out first with you, David. This is lists itself as a per curiam decision, and of course it didn't have to be that. Massachusetts versus EPA was not a per curiam decision. There were lots of thoughts. What do you see as the significance of that?
Well, first, let me hopefully start a practice of giving short answers so that we can cover a lot of questions. I think it's just a way of signifying the court's unanimity. It's also apparent from the way the opinion is written that if you follow the oral argument, you can see certain passages which sound like Tatel, and you can see certain passages which sound like Sentell. Not quite sure about Roger. She didn't say that much at oral argument. So I think it's a three-way communal effort, and they decided to put it out under the per curiam to indicate that they all three are on board.
Tim, Bill, any thoughts?
I don't disagree with David's analysis. Often per curiam involves some negotiated resolution among the justices, one that they can all agree on, and I think that's what we have here.
Okay, then David, I want to come back to you. Now I'm doing broader stuff. You've been talking about greenhouse gas and the impact of that, but do you see this decision as having a impact on non-greenhouse gas litigation in the future?
Well, let me take the liberty of first speculating on what impact it might have on other greenhouse gas cases or potential cases. The next big thing, so to speak, that's going through the rulemaking system is the power plant, as a standard for carbon pollution from power plants. And our analysis is that the law on this is pretty much the same as it is for, there's a trigger based on endangerment and contribution, and when that trigger is made, there's an obligation to issue standards. And in this case, for new power plants, also for existing power plants because of a section I won't go into called 111B. There was separate litigation over a mid-2000s decision not to regulate power plants. It was remanded to the EPA after the Massachusetts case. So on EPA's plate has been both the motor vehicle side and the stationary source side, the power plant side. And EPA proposed a standard after some delay in April. Comment period closed on Monday. I just note that 2.25 million people filed comments in support of this this proposal that we know of. Maybe there's more. And I think the basic outlines of the law on this are the same as they are for motor vehicles. So I think EPA is on very firm ground to complete that standard. And I'm sure it'll be reviewed on various grounds, but the main issues have been resolved. This case has got good standing law, or at least non-objectionable standing law in it to me, namely that you've got to have a dog in the fight to have a fight. And it has very good laws that covered on regulating under uncertainty and furtherance of the duty to protect against harm to health and threatened harm to health and the environment. So I just see this as doesn't break a whole lot of new ground in those areas. I haven't thought about what other new ground it might break. It's just very consistent with good jurisprudence on the Clean Air Act and in terms of its effect outside this area.
Bill, I'm going to ask you the same question, but in a slightly different way, because I'm going to use the formation of that question by the climate change reporter from BNA, who asked this question, which I think is similar to the question, but not exactly, that I just asked David. And his question is, was the court's ruling merely a reaffirmation of the status quo, or is there anything in the judge's decision that will have ramification for EPA's application of the PFD program for greenhouse gases or for other pollutants? Got all that, Bill?
Let me think about what part of that to start with. Well, first of all, I tend to agree with David that as far as standing and fundamental judicial review principles, there's not a lot of new ground that's broken here. There are differences between the statutory criteria for under Section 111, under the PSD program, under the Section 202 program, that mean that some of the legal issues that will be raised and debated under Section 111 are different and not necessarily resolved by what has taken place here. As far as the PSD program goes, this case is about greenhouse gases and whether and how greenhouse gases get regulated under the PSD program, because the court did not reach the arguments over the change in the statutory thresholds. Those higher thresholds are going to be the thresholds going forward. Sources have been gaining experience with those over the past year to 18 months, and I think that is the program that that we'll be dealing with under the PSD program for the foreseeable future. That's greenhouse gases. It really doesn't have any implications as far as I am concerned for other pollutants, criteria pollutants.
Bill, I want to turn to rightness for a second. You were extremely successful. You're one of the few litigants I know, and I know this is something that you were briefing and arguing, that got the court to look at something that was addressed many years ago. And is that going to have an impact on cases in the future, your ability to get the court to at least examine the EPA interpretation that dated back as far as 1978?
Well, I think, John, that we'll all be looking with fresh eyes at rightness issues going forward. I would comment, though, that greenhouse gases, to me, are a special case under the Clean Air Act for a whole variety of reasons. And among others, when the rules that EPA referred to in 1978, for example, were promulgated and were litigated in Alabama Power, it was long before, decades before, EPA and the courts had even determined that greenhouse gases were a pollutant that was subject to the Clean Air Act. So there really was no focus on greenhouse gases, which are very different from other types of pollutants regulated under the Clean Air Act. So this was a very good case for this sort of ripeness argument. And, you know, we'll have to see going forward if other cases of a similar character arise.
If I could add, the tricky thing about it is that what the court did there yesterday was say, in a collection of trade associations, there were two trade associations who couldn't reasonably have been expected to have, pursued this back then. And they didn't really address whether the other ones did, but that they focused on those two. And
of course.
Yeah, if you start thinking about
that. All it takes is two.
No, I understand that. But I'm just speculating about where it goes. If you start thinking about that from the perspective of trade associations, maybe the number of units that come into play is limited. If it goes to the question of individual companies, or for that matter, individual environmental environment of concern of citizens, you could say, you know, well, NRDC may have raised that issue in another context, but and I may even be a member of it, or I'm a member of Friends of the Earth, and, or I'm a member of nothing, and I didn't have my shot at this. It would be, there would be a cost if this starts to happen in terms of undermining the value of the 60-day rule, which is to try to get questions about the validity of regulations cited at the front end and then pave the way for companies and environmentalists and everyone to make their investments and plan their behavior on a, you know, in reliance on a stable foundation. So I'm not even, I know we contested it in the case, I'm not taking great issue with the outcome on rightness in this case, but there is this danger, which we all have to be mindful of, that if many exceptions turn out to be made for later rising challenges, then that stability from the 60-day period requirement will be lost, and there are costs if that happens. So I'm going to hope that all sides exercise restraint in availing themselves of whatever window has been opened here.
I think that's a fair comment. Excuse me. I think that's a fair comment that David has made, and that it ties back into the.
We're in standing world. One of the more certainly controversial and attracted a lot of attention in Massachusetts versus EPA was when the majority opinion gave, quote, special solicitude to the state. In this case of Massachusetts, which allowed standing in that case. Here we have states, too. It isn't just industry. We have a lot of states that are challenging EPA, and the court did not give them standing. Did the state screw up?
No. I mean, from my perspective, no. I think that we can pretty much limit this to the circumstances of this case. In fact, the court on page 81 re-underlines that same quote, saying the states are still entitled to special solicitude, but if I would paraphrase, but they need to actually still allege an injury that's not speculative and concrete and particularized. And as I went through, the states in this case, in the court's opinion, simply didn't have that injury. If you look at the rule that they were challenging, was designed very much to minimize the injury or lessen the injury that they're alleging, and not the other side. I also read, and again I defer to my colleagues who were litigants, but I read a little bit of impatience with the states to have changed, you know, in the way they changed their arguments in the reply brief to take on the same standing justification as Massachusetts, because it seemed a little bit disingenuous to the court. So I think it got a little bit of a slap down for that reason as well.
You know, there's an answer they could have given to Texas was, how can you claim an injury which, if you get the relief you want, yes, it's to strike down the threshold to cover more sources, but the real thing you said is in order to trigger Congress to cancel the whole deal. So how your real interest is in not having PSD apply. How can you claim a standing for that you're suffering an injury because of the unabated pollution? And, you know, it just struck me here that it's possible that Centel or one of them wasn't comfortable saying that, so that might explain why we have the outcome we did, which is simply you didn't proffer any evidence that you have a coast and that you're losing some of it.
I mean, there's a line in the opinion that indicates that the states really did not come up with evidence.
Yeah.
And we all know the D.C. Circuit, and actually Centel in particular, is someone who has made actually Article 3 standing something that he has been resolute about. But I have another question for you, Tim.
If I could reply just quickly to just point out that they did not make the exact point that David said, but they do point out the disconnect between the state's position in the entirety of the litigation, which doubts that there are impacts from climate change, and then to have standing based on the fact that they are impacted by climate change. This is on the bottom of page 80. So the court didn't shy away from showing a logical disconnect between the two points.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. That's useful.
All right, so here is one of the questions that has been floating now in the flurry. You know, any of you who actually type into your internet search right now, D.C. Circuit greenhouse gas decision, you'll be overwhelmed. But here's a blog entry by my friend Professor Dan Farber, who has been asked, could in fact there be standing in this particular case? And Dan says this, it seems to me that the easiest standing claim in terms of a standing rule would be competitive injury, that the plaintiff would be subject to regulation, big plaintiff, you know, the ones that get sued, but smaller competitors would not. And thereby, the bigger one is losing cost. Now, you know, imagine, I guess, hypothetically, some company that's just there, just falls narrowly into the PSD requirement, and a competitor down the street is only a few tons below that, but it's not in the competitive scheme. And Dan's point would that might be, that's not states, this is now businesses, that would be the best argument, which is the competitive injury. Tim, what do you think?
I've suspected there are those that have standing to challenge the tailoring rule, and I think I'd have to agree with Dan. I think that you could find a very concrete particularized injury if you can, you know, as long as the court accepts that there is costs, which it appears to have, associated with being regulated under this rule, if you have comparative injury because of that, it strikes me that that is a logic. I'm confident that you can find standing to challenge the tailoring rule amongst the U.S. population and U.S. economy, but this seems to be a good example.
I'm
curious to ask Bill whether that theory was considered.
It's an interesting theory and a theoretical possibility, and I think that's all I'll say. I think what is interesting, though, is that the standing discussion comes at the very end of the decision. Typically, one sees standing the first thing that is considered because it determines whether or not the court has jurisdiction to hear a case. In this case, it took the court resolving the rightness issue and then resolving the merits of the basic statutory interpretation that gave rise to the timing and tailoring rule before it even got to standing. So, in a sense, the standing issue came up at the very end only in terms of a challenge to the higher thresholds, not to the basic interpretation that led to timing and tailoring, which was really what the industry was raising in its challenges.
I'm back to David and your discussion of endangerment finding. If you do a word search on endangerment finding, somewhere on the first or second page of your internet search, you will cross over to Climate Gate. And all of you remember the enormous hue and cry when the purloin email was announced. And it went to Congress. It certainly got presented to EPA in rulemaking. David, did it matter? Did ClimateGate ultimately matter to the court?
Well, the court did what it needs to do, which is to examine whether the allegation had to disassemble it, to look at what parts of the allegations might have, you know, what they were, they have any weight to them, and could they change the outcome in Section 307, I have it under the subsection right now, part of 307B has a rule in it that, and maybe it's D7B, has a rule in it that you have to show that the error, not only was an error, but it would have changed the outcome. I'm paraphrasing. So it's a very high bar. And then they looked at, you know, against this very high bar, the trivialities that the petitioners brought forward. I mentioned a couple of them. Oh, a mistake was made about the size of the Netherlands. There were a few others. And the EPA, in its response to the petitions for reconsideration, did an incredibly thorough job of answering every single complaint. And out of the very few complaints then that the petitioners brought to the court, the court found them all to be insubstantial. So, you know, ClimateGate always was a mountain made out of a molehill, and sometimes when you get to court and you have to prove what you're claiming, that, you know, the size of the molehill becomes evident, and that's what happened here. Outside of this court process, there have been multiple investigations by scientific groups, by professional responsibility groups, of the conduct of those scientists, and there were things which shouldn't, you know, which people shouldn't write down in emails, thoughts they might not even, if they have, they shouldn't write down, and certainly not act upon, in some details about individual papers here or there. But it all doesn't amount to anything. It's all a bunch of conspiratorial fog that somehow this proves, in Jim Inhofe's words, that this is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. I hope this opinion is a turning point in getting over this anti-science, climate-denying, climate science denying nonsense that's paralyzed uniquely the American governmental system.
Bill, I have a question from you, from our audience. I'm going to read it slowly because it asks a future question, and that is, assuming EPA lowers the threshold for greenhouse gas permitting, which of course which of course they said they're going to do. You know, they've set one standard, but they say in this, you know, step at a time, that in the future they'll have a lower standard. So, question, assuming EPA lowers the threshold for greenhouse gas permitting, would an entity that was newly affected by the greenhouse gas PSD permitting requirements be able to challenge the timing and tailoring rule at that time? That is, would they be able to argue that they are having injury in fact due to the lowering of the threshold, or would the court rule that EPA lowering the threshold was reasonably foreseeable and thus that entity filed too late? And while you're thinking about that, there's a trail question that says, the entity could of course challenge the lowering of the threshold, but I was wondering if it could go back and challenge the original rule.
All right, that's a very, very interesting question.
Yeah.
There are certain questions, issues, challenges that were, of course, reached on the merits in this decision, which have been reached and would be foreclosed in the future. But with respect to a challenge to the thresholds and whether EPA had authority to raise the statutory thresholds, one could envision the sort of ripeness analysis that the court employed now being employed in the future with respect to that sort of challenge, as opposed to the broader legal interpretation issues that were resolved in this case.
Well, I mean, David, I don't understand how, let's assume that the let's assume something happens that isn't actually what EPA proposed. Step three, EPA proposed to leave well enough alone. So let's assume for a second that they notched the numbers down, and a source within that increment, you know, between the old thresholds and the new thresholds, attempts to bring the case. It's still a case. They're either claiming EPA was arbitrary in lowering the thresholds. I don't know that they could win, but I guess they would have standing to say, you know, you didn't have a rational basis for going from 75,000 to 50,000. Or it's the same claim all over again, which is you never had a basis to not to go to 250 tons straight off. And that company has the same standing problem as a bigger company had this time.
Well, I'm not sure that that's right, David. I think it's a bit more nuanced than that. There were issues regarding the agency's authority to change the statutory thresholds that were not reached this time because no one for whom the challenge was ripe had made a case for standing. But that wouldn't preclude someone for whom the challenge was not ripe now making that challenge at some point in the future.
To make it concrete, we can go back to Professor Farber's. To make it concrete, we go back to Professor Farber's theory. There would, if you lower it to 50,000, a firm that has a 51,000 ton level might be competitively disadvantaged against somebody who had a 25,000 ton level and find standing under that new theory. Now, if they find standing, they seem to be newly
affected. If they were one
newly affected, and for the first time, have the concern before them.
I think it's an interesting question. I'm not sure there's a bright line answer to it, but it certainly is something worth thinking about.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I would only say that this much is clear, and that is a new rule comes out. That's a new rule. It can be challenged, but this decision is not irrelevant to a new rule when they lower standards. Tim, I have another question for you, and that is,
sure.
How likely do you think it is that the Supreme Court would take the case? That assumes that somebody asked them to take the case, and then any speculation on how the Supreme Court would rule?
That may be one of the great unanswerable questions that everybody's asking. I can provide my own opinion, and I'm sure my colleagues can do the same. I think this is likely not to be appealed to the Supreme Court. You go back to the question that was asked of David, the per curiam opinion, the first of all, just the care with which the court approached this, the 2-day argument, the real care with which the judges prepared is not irrelevant. I think the Supreme Court knows that the D.C. Circuit has really put effort into it. The per curiam opinion between judges are really appear to be the entire swath of the court. All suggest that the Supreme Court may look at this and realize it does and decide not to take cert on it. But that's really my opinion, and probably not definitive in any way. Lastly, I think the strong language of Mass v. EPA and the fact that that precedent was so heavily relied upon here would require the Supreme Court really to feel that it was going to revisit its precedent in Mass v. EPA, and I don't see any reason with the new court's makeup and its respect for stare decisis that it would decide to do that in this case.
There's another Supreme Court case that was mentioned along the way, and Bill and I were both involved in it. It's American Electric Power versus Connecticut, and while that case was mainly about whether tort suits could be brought, and the court decided no. The reason for it is the court said this is EPA's job. We decided that in Massachusetts, and they reflected specifically about Section 111 as it relates to power plants. So I think that, and I'm just guessing, and that was an 8-0 opinion. So I'm just guessing that maybe they have greenhouse gas fatigue up there, and that would also contribute to a reluctance to take the case.
David, on that basis, I have a great trail question, but yours is good. This is the last question that we'll ask. Bill and Tim, after David speaks, I'm going to give each of you closing. Each of you give okay. 1 minute to give any last thoughts. And since Tim got last, I'm going to give Bill last voice this time. So I asked the question of David, which he'll see in a second why I'm asking it of him. And then, Tim, you get a minute, and then, Bill, you get a minute, and then we're going to close this great seminar. But here's a question for you, David. It is from our editor of High Country News. The question is, it seems environmentalists keep winning the climate fights in the courts, but losing it in the political arena. So if in the wake of this big decision, the fight will shift to Congress, what challenges do environmentalists now face? Do they need to change their strategy?
Well, those are good observations. And what I would say is that we underwent a change of strategy about 2 years ago. Actually, really 10 years ago, we started a multi-track strategy. We wanted to get a new law. We still want to get a new law. But we want to use the law we have. The law of the land. We thought it was the law of the land. Now we know it's the law of the land. And we've actually been accomplishing significant things under it. As I mentioned, the clean car standards by 2025, half the carbon pollution, double the mileage. The power plant standards that were proposed, if they're promulgated and if there's a follow-up with action under 111D, we can get significant reductions at reasonable costs in the carbon pollution from the number one source, which is power plants, at 2.3 billion tons per year. Together, cars and vehicles and power plants make up two-thirds of the CO2 inventory. So this is not small potatoes. There's been a lot of pressure on EPA and the Congress. The House has passed 200 and some odd anti-environmental bills, and they have repealed the Clean Air Act's greenhouse gas authorities, I'm guessing approaching a dozen times. The bill has failed in the Senate. The president has promised to veto any such legislation. And the current Congress, this is an exercise in hollow grandstanding from the House, and it doesn't go anywhere. We put a lot of effort into shoring up, if you will, the public support and demonstrating the public support for the Clean Air Act and for carbon pollution regulation in particular. We'll do the best we can and the most we can under the law we have until the politics of this country change in a way that supports new legislation that supplements the Clean Air Act and gets us back on a reasonable road from the madness we've been in.
Tim, you got your minute.
Great, thank you all. I think I'll just go back to what is the effect of ruling. I really might want to start with the question that is suggested and what David had to answer there, that this is an overtly political question, which is industrial interests versus environmental interests. And this ruling it closes the chapter on whether the EPA is going to regulate, but it only begins the chapter on how the most intelligent and effective way it is for EPA to use this authority or for other authorities to be established through legislation that can both address this issue and help us keep moving economically. I think this is a lot more than an environmental issue. It's a challenge to all of us. And the real magic of the moment right now is going to be, does this decision lead to us continuing to fight over the authority that EPA has and whether to try and take it away, or does it allow the debate and the conversation, I should say, to move towards a different level where we try and figure out the best way to solve the question that's before us. In an election year, I wouldn't bet on the latter in the short term, but maybe over time this conversation can mature to a place that and trying to intelligently answer the challenge that global warming presents us.
Bill, in the great words of the Washington Nationals, you're the closer.
Okay. Let me make a personal observation building on what David and Tim had to say. It's interesting to recall back to the beginning of the Obama administration when we were all working very hard on climate change legislation. At that point, there was discussion of potential Clean Air Act regulation, but it was made as a threat, everyone recognizing that the Clean Air Act and the Clean Air Act programs are not really designed for greenhouse gas climate change regulation and would be an inefficient way of pursuing the climate change regulatory objectives. I would hope that we all recall that and continue to recognize that comprehensive legislation that looks at these issues anew and replaces, doesn't supplement what's been going on under the Clean Air Act is a much more efficient way at this issue. I think, as Tim says, we're going into the election season. We're in the election season. Not a lot is going to happen on that in the near future, but I think longer term, there needs to be some fundamental rethinking of what's gone on under the Clean Air Act and what is a more direct and efficient way to accomplish the regulatory goals. So, John, that's my closing.
Thank you. I want to my deep appreciation to our three expert panelists. I think everybody on the phone will agree that we really drew well. We really got the best of the brightest here to talk to you. I have only one observation and one request. The observation is, at a time where we see controversy in our political arena, this is a week where we are looking at Supreme Court decision on immigration, a Supreme Court decision perhaps on health care, and the D.C. Circuit's decision on a greenhouse gas. We may well have chaos, but we still have a rule of law, and we, as those people who are dedicated to that in our lifetime, need to again honor the fact that we have judges who are trying to do what they think is right, and we need to be supportive of judicial independence, supportive of judicial financing, so that, in fact, we keep a nation of laws that everybody, in fact, admires across the world. And second, this is Environmental Law Institute. We did this for free. If you're not already a member, you should be. Hey, this is John Cruton as your president, signing off. Thank you to all of you. Great audience. Goodbye.
Thank you, John. Thanks.